This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Daniel Vermeer is the director of Duke University's Center for Energy Development and the Global Environment. That's a pretty impressive title. He started Coca-Cola's Community Water Partnerships Program with 500 public-private partnerships in more than 90 countries. That's an impressive accomplishment. And now he advises Fortune 50 companies on water sustainability. All of this from a guy whose stated goal in college was not to go to grad school and not to get a job. Daniel Vermeer joins us now to tell us more about his unlikely journey. Welcome, Dan. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here.
Well, let's go back to college now and talk about this plan of yours, so-called.
Sure. So I went to a little school in Michigan called Hope College. It's a liberal arts school of about 3,000 students. And I started out studying psychology, really fascinated by how people thought and behaved. But I ran through the courses in my first couple of years, and I said there's more to the human being than what I learned in my psychology course, what they can actually prove in an experimental lab. So I began to study philosophy and got really interested in, you know, people taking on the big questions. Ultimately, I met a professor at my home college, Boyd Wilson, who was the world religions professor. And, you know, early on in my college career, I remember telling somebody, why would you take a course in world religions? But once I did, I was hooked. I just fell in love with really understanding what are the things that are most important to people around the world and how different are they and what kind of insights and wisdom are embedded in these traditions. So I added a third major to study world religions and took every course that this professor offered, even set up an independent study to begin to study Sanskrit. And so I really feel like, you know, I had an incredible education in how to think and how to write and how to communicate, but I had no practical skills of any kind when I graduated from college. And that was okay with me. As you mentioned, I had three goals when I graduated. I don't want to go to grad school. I don't want a job. And I want to live in South Asia. I think studying the world religions introduced me to a world that I sort of imagined was completely different than anything I'd ever experienced from growing up in Iowa or going to college in Michigan, and you know, just was determined to find a way to get there. So that was my quest after college.
It's admirable goals, and I can certainly understand not wanting to go to grad school, and I absolutely understand not wanting a job. But the South Asia part, where'd that come from?
That's a good question. I think South Asia is, when you begin to study the cultural and literary and linguistic diversity, it's a whole world unto itself, and it's a world I knew very little bit about. And so as you begin to open up this world and realize the richness in this place, that was the initial attraction. I think as I began to study more deeply, I realized that at least for the rest of Asia, so much of the religious traditions, the philosophy, the thinking of the majority of humanity originated in India before it moved to Tibet and China and Japan and Southeast Asia. So I thought if I really want to understand the world, I have to start in India. Maybe I'll work myself out to other parts of the world eventually, but that was the route.
All of those thought systems may have been rooted there, and yet ours now in the West is very different from those thought processes and those religious concepts that began there. How so? Or am I right in that? Or is at least was that your perception at the time, that this is a very different way of understanding our world and our place in it?
I think it was because it was so different. Its fundamental assumptions about the world were so different. I think we, you know, our religious traditions are rooted in a kind of monotheistic assumption, and that's absolutely not the case as you look at the rest of the world, where it ranges from sort of polytheism, where there's a god around every corner, to variants of Hinduism and Buddhism, which are deeply atheistic. And so even within India, incredible diversity, but all of which looks very different and makes very different assumptions from the systems that we come from.
We're monotheistic in a way that has many manifestations, and it's hard for us as Westerners to get our heads around names of so-called gods who are, in effect, only manifestations of one. And so all of this, a very different way of thinking. So you decide to go to Nepal. Was that the first stop?
Yeah, it was. I when I graduated from college, I was able to get a job working in a crisis center for foreign travelers that had come to Nepal and got sick or mentally ill or strung out on drugs or lost their money or in passports. So this center was set up in the 60s when there was an overland route for Europeans to come to Asia overland across Iraq and Iran, across the Afghanistan and Pakistan into Nepal and India. Of course, that route had lots of lots of challenges, and so lots of people got in crisis on that route. So the center that I worked in was established to help find these tourists who had kind of fallen off the trail and were in crisis of various kinds. And we worked with the embassies to find these people, you know, get them back on their feet and get them home.
Now, you mentioned that you were from Iowa, and I understand that your family in Iowa was not really thrilled with this idea of yours.
Yeah, it was a pretty different world from anything that I had known growing up and anything that they were familiar with. I lived in a town that was about 8 miles from the hometowns of my mom and dad, so, you know, deep roots in that place. But when I decided to go to Nepal, the only person that they ever knew who had gone to Nepal previously was a son of one of their friends who they found dead in a hotel room. So, of course, they imagined the worst. And, you know, my mom cried for the week before I went to Nepal. She had two fears. One is that I, too, would die when I was there. She was also afraid that I would get married when I was there. So she was afraid I would find a girl with a nose ring is what she told me. You know, neither one of those things happened, and I was able to come back about 60 pounds lighter than when I left, but nevertheless really enriched by the experience.
These trekkers are mostly Westerners. They are probably in some ways kindred spirits. They're seekers in many ways, and yet, you know, there are stories about people who just really don't know what's going on with them. And I wonder what your impressions were as you saw these folks coming through, some more serious than others. Mm-hmm. Did it cause you to reflect on yourself and your own? I mean, because there are stories of people, and you think to yourself, oh, you know, this kid's an idiot. You know, he just grew up with too much around him and needs to go home and get a job. Mm. Did any of those thoughts ever occur to you and cause you to reflect on your own journey in that moment?
You know, such a diversity of people that ended up in that situation. We had a couple of women that came over the course of the time that we were there that had their first psychotic breaks in Nepal. You know, one had come from England wanting to get a new start. She knew something wasn't going right and got on a hiking trail 5 days walk from the nearest road and had a psychotic break, started trying to climb up on the buildings and jump off. The hiking guide had to personally escort that person physically down the mountain 5 days to get them to our crisis center. So for somebody like that, you know, she was just in a really vulnerable position disorder that she didn't know she had before she came. You know, some of them were hippies. We had a German guy who was traveling with his girlfriend who got to Nepal and got rheumatic fever. His legs swelled up to three times the size of normal, obviously couldn't walk, and ended up in a hospital in Nepal where the assumption is that somebody will be there to feed you, to bathe you, to take care of you, essentially. Very limited staffing to support you in that hospital stay. And the girlfriend at the time said, well, it's been great traveling with you, but I only have 5 weeks of vacation, so I'll see you back in Germany. And left this person, you know, high and dry in this Nepali hospital. So we did 24-hour coverage, went down to the hospital and took care of him until he was able to get good enough to move into our crisis center. He stayed for a couple of months, and when he recovered, he actually became part of the staff of the crisis center. So it was a pretty organic operation where you did find people who were really on the margins. But, you know, having had a kind of healing experience, then felt strong enough to be able to offer that to other people who are similarly vulnerable. So it was kind of a cool system to see that in motion.
Along the way, you had a chance to meet the Dalai Lama. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I worked in Nepal and then had a chance to travel in India. I had no idea where I was going to go, but, you know, I'm in South Asia, which is what I had come to do. And I'd always been attracted to the mountains. So traveled in the mountains, ended up in a village called Dharamshala, which is where the Tibetan government in exile is in India. The Dalai Lama has been based there since the late 50s when he fled Tibet, and that they have reconstituted the Tibetan government in this small village in India. I signed up to take a course in Buddhism and Tibetan culture. And while I was in that class, the Dalai Lama happened to be in his home residence, and the teacher was able to arrange a meeting with the Dalai Lama. So there were about 15 of us that were able to go down to his monastery. You can imagine these foreigners, Germans, you know, Israelis, Scandinavians, waiting to meet the Dalai Lama, some of which imagine that he was a kind of deity, which is very un-Buddhist, but that was sort of the expectation. And he came in the room, and immediately you could sense this guy had a really different energy. For one, very small, always on the edge of a giggle. And came in bowing and said, you know, nice to meet you, with this booming baritone voice. And thought, wow, you know, very impressive voice out of this, you know, small body. Sat down, and the teacher said, you know, we've prepared questions we'd like to share with you, His Holiness. First one is psychological, Western psychotherapy has ways of dealing with psychological disorders, and so does Tibetan Buddhism. Are these complementary or contradictory? And the Dalai Lama, knowing that there's an audience of people waiting for the word from on high to come down, said, this is very difficult. And you could feel the panic in the room. This is not difficult. That was a softball question. So he came up with an answer. And of course, it's, you know, complementary, that you should find truth wherever you can find it. And these can work together. And he got done, had a little twinkle in his eye, said, but I don't know. And he started giggling. And I thought, wow, I reflected on that afterwards. I think he knew that there were many of the people in the audience who wanted him to provide the answers to their questions. And I think what he did is provided an answer, but he punctured that with a little laughter, a little joke at the end. May not have even known it happened, but it was a teaching about, I think, Buddhist philosophy and where you need to really look for your answers.
More about what you learned from that and other adventures as our conversation with Daniel Vermeer continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Daniel Vermeer, director of Duke University's Center for Energy Development and the Global Environment. And we're talking about your time in Nepal. You met the Dalai Lama and this sort of wonderful moment where, you know, he gets asked this grave question, this polarity between Western psychology and Eastern, meditative religion, and he chuckles his way through. But there's a kind of genius in pointing to the liminality of that and not wanting to play into your binary. You know, you've set up a binary. My answer is anal binary. Mm-hmm. Watch this. I'll laugh my way through it. Mm-hmm. What else did you take away from that experience? Because I understand you met Gandhi's grandnephew as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it just incredible that when I went to India, I counted out my money and I counted out the days that I could get a visa to last. And I had a budget of $8 a day. And that had to cover everything, food, transportation, lodging, everything. Medicine when I needed it. And so I was, you know, really, you know, operating on a total shoestring out there, completely dependent on people for getting around and surviving in that kind of environment. And I think the predominant feeling I have is just incredible gratitude for the generosity I had from people. Because I was out there and so vulnerable, I met so many people who had so little that took care of me, who knew that I was vulnerable and not only like physically provided for me, but created these incredible opportunities for insight and connection with people who didn't know me at all and yet, thrived on that human connection. So from all those experiences, you know, in one way, very exotic experiences, what I take away from it is something I think much more simple, which is, to be out in the world, engaging with people in that, right, there's a kind of recognition that you have with people that you meet every day, which forms an immediate bond, and it creates incredible opportunities for you. And so I feel very much, you know, since then, a sense of debt, really, to maybe not to those individuals, but to the people who also you know, are in similar situations to what I was, and a sense of openness that no matter where I go, I know the majority of people out there are looking for that connection, looking for a way to be connected with each other. So that was a really heartening learning that I think wasn't philosophical. It was very personal and emotional, and I think I've really taken that into my life.
Well, but you point, I think, to an important philosophical point that was coming to me as you spoke, that people are looking for this, and yet we do belong, right? We're connected. We have a religion, and that's an identity. We have a nation, that's an identity, a language group, a racial group that we can all identify with. We have that group. And yet there's something about precisely our vulnerability, our inability to provide everything for ourselves, that according to you in that experience is the most common bond. That's the one thing that would unite every one of us on the earth. We're all really vulnerable, and these structures that we've created in the name of a nation or a god are transient.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think it was interesting. When I was in college, I spent a semester in Austria, and I remember all the other students there trying to fit in, trying to be Austrian. They're trying to sound Austrian and look Austrian and be Austrian. I always thought that was kind of false. They aren't Austrian. So it was very freeing to go to South Asia and not try to be Indian or Nepali. Nobody was going to second guess. I was clearly a foreigner. I was a lot whiter and a lot taller than anyone else in the environment. And so they knew I was different, and that was okay. And whatever little efforts I made to learn a bit of their language, you know, eventually I learned some of the folk songs in the mountains. And if I could walk into a village, I could speak a few words of their language and then sing a favorite folk song. The day was over. I was like the Pied Piper. I mean, they called it a day. Everybody got together, and we're going to sing songs because this guy's made a little bit of an investment to know who we are. And so, you know, the threshold was very low to find that connection. And I think, you know, unfortunately, I find those opportunities harder to find in this environment and at this stage in my life than I did then. But I think it's something that I constantly aspire to.
Well, we'll talk about how you're doing that now and kind of repurposing those experiences in your current position. But I do want to talk about a moment when you must have felt very much out of place and very different. And that is when you created a basketball league.
So when I was living in Kathmandu, they had just gotten cable TV a few months before I arrived, and this was a revolution. They started getting channels with shows they had never seen before, including TBS out of Atlanta. So you can imagine in this little hut in Kathmandu watching TV, and an Atlanta Hawks game came on with these enormous guys, you know, jumping through the roof, slamming the ball in a game that they didn't really know. This completely captured the attention, especially of the young males. And so they got a basketball, and they started trying to figure out themselves how to play. And they eventually approached me and said, listen, we really want to form a league in this country. Would you help us? And I, you know, this is one of those things that you just can't pass up. And so I said, absolutely, I'd love to. I've always been a huge fan of basketball. That goes from my Iowa days to here in North Carolina. That's one of the strands of continuity. But we formed a league. We recruited 8 teams from around the country, from the urban areas. In some places, we had to actually lay the concrete on a flat piece of ground, which isn't always easy to find in Nepal, so people could play basketball. And we formed teams. My team, they told me I had to go pick up my uniform. So I went down to the tailor shop, and he took out the uniform that they got for me. It was a polyester shirt, blue leopard print, with a blue satin shorts to go with it, and similarly bad quality polyester. And the biggest size they had was still much too small for me. So the tailor had to cut open the armhole and the neck hole and the leg hole. So when I wore this uniform and, you know, running down the court, I looked like kind of a blue version of the Incredible Hulk. It was clearly different than anything I had worn before. But that was the outfit. And we put together a national tournament. About 600 people showed up for this national tournament right in the heart of Kathmandu. They gave me a Nepali name, so I was Kaji Bahadur Gurung, even though they had given each other all NBA names. So this is Michael Jordan, this is John Paxson, this is Bill Laimbeer, and then I was Kaji Bahadur Gurung. So
what does that mean?
Kaji is exalted, Bahadur is courageous. And Gurung is the name of the ethnic group that I was essentially adopted by. It's a name that the Gurungs send many of their young people into the British Army. And so they have a real kind of martial character, and this is a name that carries a lot of significance to them. So they gave me that name as well, and I was truly adopted by that community.
So how'd you do?
Well, we made it to the finals, but there actually were like bigger guys than me that were Nepali and really good athletes. The guys that run around the mountains all their whole lives are incredible athletes. So we lost in the final game, but I was voted the most valuable player of the tournament. I'm not sure I was the most valuable player. I think I was probably outstandingly white and noticeable, but
most improved.
Yeah, but in my CV since that time, I always have MVP of the NBA 1994. And that's always a great way to start a conversation in an interview.
This would be the Nepali...
The Nepal Basketball Association, that's right.
Way to
that's
go.
That's my claim to fame. I have a little 3-inch statue to prove it.
That's fantastic. Well, and what brought you there? Because this was actually your second tour. You went back, studied anthropology, and came back. Tell us a little bit about the place where you were, because this was the British military had been recruiting there, right?
That's right. So the village I ended up doing research in is a place called Barpak. The way you got there is you took an old bus for 6 hours from the capital city of Kathmandu on very narrow roads, sometimes one lane where two buses need to pass each other. So you really take your life in your hands, look down in the ditch saying, the driver must know what he's doing. But then you see a charred bus, 4,000 feet down, thought, well, that was driven by somebody who knew what they were doing, too, apparently.
Start thinking of your mother's warning at
this
point. Yeah,
maybe she had some wisdom that I didn't have at that point. Clearly, I was pretty naive. But that's the bus ride. It takes you 6 hours to a little village called Gorkha. The bus stops, you get out, and you grab your backpack, and then you walk for 3 more days up into the mountains. And there are little houses along the way that are used to foreigners coming through, so you could find a bed and a place to sleep and a meal of rice and dal. But it was 3 days' walk from the nearest road, the last 4 hours of which was up switchback stairs. And you can't see the village from below. So as you're going up, all you see is this line of mountains up to 28,000 foot peaks, the spine of the Himalayas, the highest mountains in the world. And it's an act of faith to believe that there's a village at the end of that road. I remember one of the first trips walking up there, and an old man, probably in his 60s, came and passed me. He was going twice as fast as I huffed up these stairs. And he turned around and said, "So, where are you from?" In good English, British English. And I thought, where did that come from? I said, "Well, I'm from the U.S. He said, "Have you ever been to Hong Kong?" "No, I haven't." "Well, let me tell you about it." And this man had spent his whole life in the British Army in what they call the Gurkha regiments. The Brits fought the Nepalis in the early 1800s in a war where the Brits had guns and the Nepalis didn't. So the Brits won, but they were so impressed with the fighting skill of the Nepalis, they said, "We want them on our team." So since the early 1800s, these Nepalis had the cream of the crop boys had been recruited into the British Army and spent their whole adult lives traveling all over the world. So this village was incredibly remote, and yet in a very strange way, it was also very cosmopolitan and undergoing incredible change, environmentally, economically, politically. Was an area that eventually was one of the origins of the Nepali Civil War, the Marxist movement in Nepal. So this was prior to that break, but you could tell that there was a lot of ferment, real change happening.
The world had broken in quite clearly and had been there for over 100 years now and more. So what were you doing? What brought you there?
So I was studying anthropology at University of Virginia. I had learned to speak Hindi and Nepali, and I had spent summers back working on my language skills. This was a year of research to go back and explore my research topic, which was studying child development in the context of radical sociocultural change. So what I was interested in is most models of socialization assume that the challenge is that is for parents to pass a static culture onto the children, and how do they do that? So all of the literature sort of assumes that culture is stable over time, and the interactions in the family between parents and children and other socializing adults is what allows the child to inherit that culture. what happens when that culture is changing dramatically and where the world that the kids are going into is so different than the ones that the parents came from. And by the way, this was not a culture that had been static before either. I mean, for almost 200 years, you know, the adult males had been, you know, going into the British and the Indian armies. So it was never stable, but the pace of change was dramatic. And the interactions in the families, many times the kids knew things that the parents didn't know about and had to navigate challenges that the parents really couldn't help them with. So my study was to try to understand how that dynamic, you know, between parents and children in the family changed in the context of such dramatic change.
And the impact that would have on the community and change
Absolutely.
Going forward.
Yeah.
So and then you went, you got a PhD then, you left there, and is that when you went back to get a PhD in learning sciences?
Yeah, I guess a few things happened. One is that, you know, when I went to graduate school in anthropology, it allowed me to get that immersion experience in another culture. I learned the language. I took a lot of coursework. I really understood. And I was living in this village days walk from the nearest road. Once I had that experience, I kind of felt like mission accomplished on that goal. And the other big insight I had in Nepal is, when I went originally, I think I went with the intention of getting outside the bubble. I wanted to understand what the world looked like outside the global economy, the system of globalization, what the world looked like in its pristine state, maybe was my naive assumption. And I got to Nepal and I realized that even 3 days walk from the nearest road, globalization had shot through every dimension of the lives of these people. That was a wake-up call for me to realize there is no outside. We're all in this together.
Let me stop you there because the assumption of your research is the world has crashed in on these people. Their culture is not stable because of the outside forces. So
Right. You
must have known that there was some kind of outside force that you were going to study. What was it about what you saw that seemed different to you that really kind of shook your perception?
I guess at some point the Dutch part of me really kicked in. And instead of just studying these dynamics and mourning the kind of loss of coherence and the, you know, systems that were unequal and hurting these communities, the part of me that said, I want to intervene. I want to figure out where there are points of leverage, because clearly these people are involved in a global system, but they're at the powerless periphery. So what fascinated me was, if we're all in this together, but these people really are recipients of other people's decisions, some of which may be positive, but many of which end up being quite destructive in these communities, I thought, who's at the center? Who are the people who are making decisions every day? And I'm thinking, you know, CEOs and senior executives of global companies. How do they make decisions? I had no idea. I had never had experience in the private sector. But I was fascinated now that I had reframed the challenge as, this is a system that's completely connected. And there are some people who have a lot of power to make decisions. They're making those decisions on behalf of the interests of their firm and their shareholders, which that's what business does. That's how it's built. It should do that. But it does so in many cases with this collateral damage, where there's a kind of a cascade of impacts of those decisions that might lead to deforestation, which was clearly a huge problem in Nepal, that can lead to farmers being driven into poverty because they are squeezed so hard as part of global supply chains, that, you know, ultimately the Nepalese that were recruited into the British Army were put on the front lines of wars that really were not of their own making. So I was really intrigued to think, well, who are the people who are making these decisions? I had to assume that they weren't evil, that these decisions were not ill-intended. But I also assumed that they probably didn't have a full understanding of the cascade of impacts every one of their decisions would make, from how they source to the products they sell to what markets they open up to who is part of their supply chain. All these things have dramatic impacts, almost impossible to count or really to account for. And I wanted to know how that process worked. So that led me to really turn 180 degrees. Instead of trying to get outside the system, I now wanted to go for its jugular.
But interestingly enough, you saw the system as that corporate boardroom and not because another conclusion could be to access the political apparatus and say we must control and configure and in some ways proscribe this kind of behavior on the part of CEOs. But you're saying, no, let's get into the brain there and see how much tinkering we can do with that thought process.
Yeah. And, you know, I think to understand the system, you can't silo these different pieces of the puzzle. So it was never pursue the private sector for the sake of that. They're the only ones that matter. Clearly, they operate in a political, a regulatory context that has incredible impacts on their everyday decision making. And I don't think you can understand the private sector outside understanding the context of these other influences. And I very well could have, you know, decided on a political career, having seen what I saw might have been more direct. But I saw something really potentially powerful and positive in the generative power of the private sector to create new solutions, to create new economic models, to innovate our ways toward better ways of operating. And I thought, you know, if there's a way to intervene in that decision-making process where this broader consideration set was part of the discussion, you know, that I truly believe that wasn't just a matter of government kind of cracking down on the private sector. I did believe, at least, you know, from a distance, that this looked like it had the potential in some cases to be a win-win. And that was really attractive to me, to find a way where you can begin to align incentives where there's a lot of ways to win as a business, some of which has a lot of other winners and some of which has a lot of losers. I wanted to find a way to get that alignment.
Well, let's find out what you found and what you did about it when our conversation continues with Daniel Vermeer, who is now the head of the Center for Energy Development and the Global Environment at Duke's Fuqua School. We'll talk more about that and sustainability and business when our conversation continues. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today with Daniel Vermeer, the director of the Center for Energy Development and the Global Environment at Duke's Fuqua School of Business. So we're talking about this epiphany. You had this sense that that what businesses do makes makes a big difference around the world, a couple of ways to approach it, and you decide to come at it from the business point of view. You get a job with Coca-Cola. Tell us about working for Coke.
Sure. So, you know, Coca-Cola was the culmination of a long process from Nepal to eventually work myself to the boardroom via a PhD that I earned from Northwestern University in learning sciences, ended up at Xerox PARC and did my PhD research studying organizational learning and product development communities, each step getting me closer to that kind of interface of business decision makers, very self-consciously trying to build a kind of track record of credibility that would bring me to that. While I was in Silicon Valley, I got a call from a headhunter who was looking to fill a position at Coca-Cola. And I laughed. I thought, oh, you know, Coca-Cola, I can't imagine what I could offer to a company, like come up with some new flavor or something. Wasn't obvious, but the position was to help form a new think tank that the CEO wanted to create. His frustration is he felt nobody in the company was thinking more than a couple of years ahead, and it's a company that's been around 100 years. So he wanted a think tank to look at the long-term strategic issues that the company should be paying attention to and weren't. He also wanted it in New York instead of Atlanta because he thought we'd get pulled into the bureaucracy if we were in Atlanta. So, you know, the think tank was created on Fifth Avenue and 55th in the old Columbia Pictures building. And 10 of us sat around a table, said, now what? What does a think tank do? How do we even decide what to work on? It was an incredible opportunity, though, because we had direct access to the CEO of one of the most important global companies in the world with a mandate to challenge him to think about things he's not thinking about. And so this was kind of what I had always imagined doing. Here was my chance to do
it. What were you thinking about? What'd you tell him?
Well, so we did a series of projects. I worked on global aging, for example, and looking at demographic change. But in the second year, our team decided to do a project on the future of water resources. I didn't know much about this. I didn't even vote on this as the project we should work on. But I was convinced, and the two people who were the environmentalists were too busy to lead the project. I said, well, I'll lead it. I like leading projects, and I'll get us started anyway. So I began studying water resources, and I had, again, another epiphany. There's a series of these through my career. This epiphany was, this is what I've been looking for my whole life, which is water is fundamental to everything we care about. It's fundamental to ecosystems. It's fundamental to food and agriculture, food supply, public health. Over almost a billion people who don't have access to safe water, and the impacts on public health. Women's issues, women who need to carry water from distant sources, incredible social costs of unclean water. And I happen to be in a company that's all about water. So here was the chance not to do some corporate social responsibility kind of window dressing marketing plan to tell a good story about something that really didn't amount to much. This is a chance to really strategically make the case that this company was either going to be a villain or it was going to be a partner to those who can help drive solutions around an issue that is so critical. Water is non-negotiable. We have to solve this problem. There are no substitutes. And so this was an incredibly exciting opportunity to not take this on as a marketing approach, but really a core strategic issue. The company had to do it differently than they were.
Well, let me just sort of offer these as assertions, and then you correct them as I go.
Sure.
I mean, if you're Coca-Cola, you depend on water, you want to go into a place, especially a developing country, you just want to claim the water, get as much of it as you can for as little as you can possibly spend, and do that, and that's what you do. And I'm guessing they have enormous political and economic capital, so they get away with a lot of that. And you come along and say, somehow, we have to partner, we have to think about the impact of this, and they say, they just pour to their quarterly earnings and say, go away. I mean, what case do you make to a company that has been able to do that profitably, that somehow they might have to perhaps in the short term threaten some of that profitability for this larger goal?
You know, I think there's no way, not easily anyway, to claim the resource and deny others access to something that is so fundamental to a survival. So we didn't see a lot of examples of Coke hoarding water. Maybe there are places that I didn't see that is happening. I wouldn't deny that. But my experience was increasing stress around this resource, which is a shared resource, which, by the way, is infinitely renewable if it's treated well. So it doesn't have to be like a mineral or a fossil fuel where there's a finite supply that somebody gets it and somebody doesn't. This is something. Water, by its nature, is part of a closed loop system that, if you interact with it correctly, you don't pollute it, and you put it back into the system in a way that makes sense, can serve everybody's interests. In fact, the only way really to intervene on water issues often is to intervene theoretically at the top of the watershed, at the place where the water originates. And by intervening there, you benefit, but so does everybody else who lives in that watershed. So the beauty of intervening on water is it's not something that you do tactically locally. You have to think systemically about the you know, hydrological environment that you live in and find a way to intervene in a way that preserves that resource long term. Coke does not have the expertise to do that on their own. So it has to be in partnership with governments, with NGOs, and with other stakeholders that share access to this resource. The other piece of the equation was that we did 2 years of work and spent several million dollars to do a detailed risk assessment of water resources all the way down to the plant level, because we knew water issues are very different depending on where you are. London's water issues are not Nairobi's water issues. So we had to characterize what are the challenges to water resources in those places. How do we gather data? And we did from almost 1,000 plants around the world to characterize the kind of complexion of water risks that the company faces. Now, how to intervene in those risks? We created both incentives and new standards that made it in the interest of the company to figure out how to get on the right side of these issues, how to mitigate those risks and invest so that those risks could be reduced over the long term, how much it would cost to make those interventions, and how much the cost of non-action would be around these. And so ultimately, in the end, we reduced this to a kind of insurance premium mindset. If there's $5 billion of exposure that the company faces around water issues, and you could mitigate half of it. Half of it you can't because of broader climate impacts or development, whatever. But let's say you could reduce that risk by half. Would you pay $2.5 billion? No, you'd never pay the potential cost in a premium. Would you pay $1 billion? No. Would you spend $500 million to begin to get on the right side of this issue? Maybe. So I think what the risk assessment allowed us to do is make a case to the company about its pragmatic interest in investing in these issues before they went south. And there were examples, for example, in India, where the company got on the wrong side of that equation, were seen by activists and local communities as a bad actor around water resources in a context of, you know, more and more scarcity and quality problems around water issues. And it dramatically impacted the company, the company's bottom line. So while we were building a proactive story all over the world, we had an example of what it looks like to not do it right, and that was the shadow of what the future would look like if the company didn't act.
And that's the case you make in the boardroom. But when you talk about the political impact, the and political and economic impact on the people who's who have these plants in the countries, I think you had a moment in Kenya where you realized how powerful this can be if you take water seriously.
Right. So we did different kinds of projects in different parts of the world. In Africa, we found that one of the biggest challenges was the potential for conflict with other users and the lack of access that people had to safe water. So we did a project with a local NGO to build a well along with a set of latrines to keep the waters clean in that community. I was there for the commissioning ceremony, and it was a great display. The school kids came out and danced for us. So we commissioned this well. The well had been there about 6 months. After the commissioning ceremony, I was walking back to the car, and I was approached by a group of Kenyan women, and they were pointing and talking to each other. Finally, one grabbed me by the arm and said, "I need to talk to you." And I thought, wow, I don't know what's going to happen here. She said, "Let me tell you what life was like before we had water." Said, "We had to walk 5 hours every day to the nearest water source. And two and a half hours each way there and back each morning. Our daughters came with us because we could only do one trip. And so our daughters weren't going to school. They were carrying water with us. We never knew if that water was clean or not. Sometimes we were charged exorbitant rates by the community who did control that well. And this defined our lives." And then the women behind her began to, you know, sort of encourage her to, in Swahili, and finally said, okay, they're telling me, tell them the good part. She said, "So now we have water and it comes to the edge of our yard." So this has made a huge difference for us. First of all, we have 5 hours we never had every single day. So we get up in the morning, we have 5 hours we never had otherwise. We're able to send our daughters to school because they don't have to carry water with us. So they're now being educated. This has been transformative to us. So we started planting gardens because we had the time and the water to plant gardens. So we're growing vegetables. This has worked out so well, we're starting to produce a surplus. In fact, my friends and I, the four of us, go down to the market every day and we sell the surplus vegetables that we're growing in our yards. And we now have a revenue stream. And in fact, this has gone so well, we decided that we would pool the resources of the four of us. And she said, "You see those tables and chairs that you were sitting at for the commissioning ceremony? Those are ours." We were able to raise enough money from the sale of the vegetables to buy tables and chairs, and now we run an events business. And so this is in 6 months, and it blew me away because of the transformative power of water. And this is not primarily a story about Coca-Cola. I think it's a story about water, and it's a story about the ingenuity and the entrepreneurship of the women who took that little window of opportunity, the additional time and clean water, and converted that into a social capital that made the lives of their family better.
Amazing.
So that kept me going for a year.
That's good. I mean, it's an amazing story, though. I did think you were going to say they recognized you as the MVP of the Nepal.
I don't think they made it to Nepal. No.
Incredible story because of the political empowerment. Education equals political power, economic power, all of that, because you're paying attention to this thing that can be off the map. So tell us about your academic work now at the Center for Energy Development and Global Environment.
Right. So about 5 years ago, I'd been at, in the private sector for almost 10 years, most of that at Coca-Cola. And the reason I didn't want to go into academics initially is I didn't feel like I had really learned what I wanted to teach. I didn't know how to take on big institutions and find the levers of change to really shift the way that companies think and act around these issues to achieve a better outcome. After 10 years in the private sector with this experience at Coca-Cola, I felt like now I actually do have the insights and the experiences that I think I now have the ability to share with students who could go into similar kinds of roles. I was one person working on one issue in one company, but imagine being able to influence the careers and the aspirations and the skill sets of really top-tier students that are going ultimately to become the business leaders of the future. So I was approached by Duke University to help them create a program in corporate sustainability and ultimately to create the Center for Energy Development in the Global Environment, which we call the EDGE Center. The mission of EDGE is to work in the school. We're based in the business school, and our mandate is really to transform not just offering sustainability courses or courses in energy or resource management, but to really infuse the broader school with the capabilities and the visions so that every student, regardless of what industry they go into, what function they want to work in, has a vision of the broader context that business operates in. So we're really in the school to be a catalyst to help students understand beyond their core skill sets in accounting and finance and marketing. They operate and business operates in a social and political and environmental context, which is really critical for them to be business leaders in the future, because that context is where all of the big risks, and by the way, all of the entrepreneurial opportunities of the future are going to come from meeting those unmet needs. So our center, creates new courses, both curricular and extracurricular experiences. We work very closely with the Energy Club and the Net Impact Club in creating events to really bring in the best and the brightest sort of leading thinkers in this area. We do research on a whole range of issues, including work that we've begun in China. And we're really the liaison to industry, bringing people who are doing cutting edge work onto campus and getting our students out into the world to begin to work with leading business executives around these issues.
Tell us about that work in China.
Sure. So this semester has really been focused on China. I spent 3 weeks there in January doing some initial work. China is a kind of classic case study in exactly the dynamics of what our center was built to explore. The dynamics of global development, 1.5 billion people all aspiring to a middle class quality of life. An incredibly accelerated program of building out the energy and infrastructure systems to support that quality of life. And in a context of an environment that, is limited in resources, water and other natural resources are limited in the China context. So how can China navigate the tensions between these poles that are inherently often in conflict? And what role can business play in coming up with catalytic opportunities that actually ease that tension, that find new ways of balancing those priorities? So one of the things that we're doing is leading a group of 90 MBA students to China in May. We do a 6-week orientation course with them, teaching them about Chinese history, politics, economics, and then a 2-week immersion experience meeting with business leaders and political leaders in China to try to understand where there are opportunities to rebalance these three pillars of the EDGE agenda. The other thing we're doing is that we are doing a forum on China clean tech on March 26 and bringing together some of the leading thinkers in clean technologies that can provide new opportunities to meet people's needs for quality of life while easing the burden on the skies and the water resources and so forth. So.
Very promising stuff. Daniel, pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much. I've enjoyed it.
Daniel Vermeer directs the Center for Energy Development and the Global Environment at Duke's Fuqua School of Business. If you want to find out more, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.